In all the debates over how to best protect the planet from climate change, air and water pollution, shrinking biodiversity, and other environmental problems, population control is rarely mentioned. But a stunning and scary new book of photographs hopes to make the point that limiting population growth may be the answer to many of Earth's problems. Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot, published by Gough Books, is a collaboration between the Population Institute, the Population Media Center, and the Foundation for Deep Ecology. And I'm very pleased to welcome the book's editor, Tom Butler, to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
This is a large format coffee table book of beautifully printed photographs, but it's clearly not meant to be seen as an art book. Why did you decide to create such a beautiful package for such a sobering message?
Because the book's objective and the book's execution is really, really simple. We wanted to show this particular moment in time. We wanted to show how the Earth is being transformed by 7.3 billion human beings in the way we've chosen to organize our economic activities. And the way to do that is to essentially present a slideshow of the Earth.
The book opens with a graph showing the rise of the world's population from 1 billion in 1800, 2 billion in 1930, 3 billion in 1960, 4 billion in 1975. And after that, we add a billion people every 12 years. Does that mean the rate of growth is slowing down a bit?
The rate of growth has slowed down a bit. But I want to comment on that particular graph that you mentioned. If you had to, if you were going to show it out toward the left, that famous hockey stick graph, you would see that through almost the entire history of Homo sapiens, of our species, population growth was essentially flat. It was stable. You know, it took a couple hundred thousand years since we emerged as anatomically modern human beings till the year roughly 1800 before we even got to a billion. And then that trajectory spikes upward. Now, the point I want to make here is that this is an abnormal time in history. This is very, very unusual because every other time the vast majority of time, human beings lived in communities where within a single or even a couple of human lifetimes, you would have never even noticed population growth. And now that trajectory is so fast, and yet, for the most part, we're not talking about it.
We're now at 7.3 billion, and you estimate we'll reach 8 billion by the year 2025. Can that be avoided? Do we start to change things now?
Yes, it can
and
be avoided.
And is family planning the answer?
Family planning is the answer, and that is the one thing that we stress throughout the book and throughout its associated Population Speak Out campaign. The answer to this question of how to slow and then eventually stop the human population trajectory is very straightforward. It's not a mystery. Musimbi Kanyoro, the head of the Global Fund for Women, who wrote the book's foreword, says in the foreword to the book, our problem is not ignorance. Our problem is not ignorance. We know how to do this. If you empower women and you elevate the status of girls in particular and educate them, and you make family planning tools and information universally available, birth rates go down, and they go down very quickly, and this happens across cultures.
What about religions that discourage birth control, and the Roman Catholic Church that forbids artificial contraception?
It's highly problematic. But as we know,
not likely to change.
Cultural attitudes and cultural norms certainly do change, and sometimes they change remarkably quickly. In the last couple of weeks, what have we seen in our society? We've seen how people who were a formerly marginalized category of people, gay and lesbian people, were granted equal rights. Well, that was something that would be unthinkable. Marriage equality would have been unthinkable just a few short years ago. And now it is a cultural norm, broadly accepted. And so similarly, in terms of population size, a couple of generations ago in the United States, it was not uncommon for people to have 7, 8, or 9 children. That's now, we have a very different norm now. And this also can happen in cultures where there are religious norms. Until very recently, the shining example of this was in Iran, where a family planning program that stressed education for young married couples and the ability to access family planning tools dramatically lowered the birth rate in that country in a way that was consistent with its cultural and religious traditions.
Can't putting limits on population growth be seen as taking away people's freedom of choice? When China started its one-child policy, wasn't it often criticized as being restricted?
Yes, it was. And I don't know if anyone in the modern family planning community or in the population world that says anything except for this. Family planning should be implemented as part of the universal human rights framework, giving women in particular, but women and their partners, the tools and information they need to bring the number of children they want onto the earth in the way and in the spacing that they would wish. That is to say, coercion, either to have children or to not have children, is always wrong.
What happened in China? Did it reverse population growth at all?
And it did slow.
Hasn't it been eased now?
It did slow population growth. Yes, it did.
But it's been eased because it was too repressive.
Yes.
We have countries like India. We have other countries where we're seeing major population explosions.
That is true. So there are I'm going to go back to these three areas of sort of civil engagement about empowering women, educating girls, and making family planning tools and information universally available. That can be done in a way that stresses the autonomy and the dignity of people and gives them choice and access and information as part of a human rights framework. It is not coercion to do that. In fact, it is a way to alleviate suffering both for the planet and for people.
Tom Butler is the editorial projects director of the Foundation for Deep Ecology and the president of the Northeast Wilderness Trust. He's a conservationist and writer, and his books include Wildlands Philanthropy, Plundering Appalachia, Keeping the Wild, and Energy Over Development and the Delusion of Endless Growth. And we're talking about a new book called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. I understand the first two words. What is overshoot have to do with this?
Well, it's a commonly known word. If you overshoot where you intended to go, you've gone past it. But in terms of ecology, it is more of a wonky or technical term, and it refers to that phenomenon whereby an organism becomes so abundant that it begins to outstrip the carrying capacity of its habitat. That degrades and eventually leads to a population crash. Now, you've kindly mentioned the book's title a couple of times. That might have just as easily been phrased as an equation. Because overpopulation, that is numbers, plus overdevelopment, that is the way we organize our economic activities, equals global overshoot. We have overshot the carrying capacity of Earth.
And at what point do you feel there'll be just too many people on the planet? In the book's introduction, William Ryerson, president of the Population Institute and founder of the Population Media Center, says that we could have 27 billion people on the planet by the end of this century. That's a lot more than most estimates, which are around 10 billion.
I think he said essentially that would be impossible because we already have overstripped the carrying capacity of the Earth to deal with our waste. We've already broken the climate. And
so
we're
past the ideal number?
Absolutely. Thus the word overpopulation. Now, how could we know that? What would the symptoms show us if we thought we had already achieved ecological overshoot of the planet? Well, there would no longer be the capacity to absorb all of our wastes. Well, we've done that. We have a phenomenon of global climate chaos because we've been putting too much carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gas pollution into the atmosphere. So we've broken the climate. That would be a pretty good indication that we have overshot. We also have a global extinction crisis, arguably the biggest news on Earth in 65 million years. And so that's also a pretty good indication of ecological overshoot.
And the extinction is, to some degree, because humans just keep on moving into more and more land that was inhabited by other animals?
That is precisely correct. We have appropriated almost all of the really fecund, the Earth's most biologically rich places are now either occupied or affected by human activities.
What about the ability to adequately feed everyone?
Well, we're certainly not adequately feeding everyone.
I've been told that we could. It's just a matter of how we allocate our resources, and we're rather inefficient.
Well, that's certainly true that we are inefficient. But let's look at this idea of feeding ourselves. if we wanted to feed everyone, and in a perfect world, we could amplify our innovation in agriculture and industrialize everything, it might theoretically be possible. Is it likely? Is it going to happen? There are between 800 and 900 million people on Earth right now, at this moment, who are in effect starving, either slowly or a little faster. There are another billion plus on the Earth right now whose economic circumstances, if they were to shift just in the slightest, they would be in that category of starving. So a very, very large percentage of the human population already is either malnourished or in danger of that.
Could the planet support more people if we all used renewable energy and public transportation, became vegans, consumed less, recycled everything that we possibly could?
Could it? Maybe. I don't know. Does that matter? Is that even a useful question? The question we should be asking is, what is the world that we want? Do we want a world of beauty and diversity, where we share the planet with other creatures, with the diversity of life, where there's a flourishing human civilization embodied in a context of wild nature, where we have discharged our social responsibilities to be ethical people because we try to alleviate suffering, both of other people and non-human nature? Well, that's a world that I'd like to work toward, not a world that is so managed, so artificially engineered by technocrats that we can fit 7 billion or 12 or 15 billion. That's not a world that I would welcome.
And it seems that we are trusting technology to get us out of this mess.
There are an amazing amount of techno-optimism out there. There certainly is. And thank goodness that the Pope has not bought into it. The encyclical that we just read from the Pope was astounding for several reasons, not the least of which was it very explicitly critiqued this idea of technological optimism, of a techno-industrial growth economy anchored by corporate capitalism. And even more important than this, even more fundamentally than this, this was something that got no notice that I saw in the mainstream American media. None. There was a little bit of, the Pope talks about climate change. How many people noted that the encyclical explicitly talked about human-centeredness, this problem of anthropocentrism, and how, in fact, we have, if we are good Catholics or even just moral people, have an ethical responsibility to leave enough room for other species because they have intrinsic value. They are part of God's creation.
But when the Pope issued the encyclical, there was an awful lot of pushback, in fact, from people who had cited him as a major authority up until that moment. Why do you think the idea of population control isn't brought up more? Is it because it's politically unpopular?
Well, first of all, you're the first person that I've heard use the term population control in a few decades. No one talks about population control since the 1960s. We talk about a voluntary family planning and empowering women to make good choices within a universal human rights framework. I don't know anybody who talks about population
control. I'm sorry, I used the phrase.
Control. But what was the question?
The question is it not brought up as much because it's politically unpopular?
Exactly. What other topic in American political life, in our public discourse, do you get pushback? Do you get so much pressure not to talk about it from both the political right and the left? I can't think of another one. On the right, we've got people worried about talking about what? Sexuality. Human rights, gender equity, abortion rights, immigration, all kinds of hot-button issues there. And on the far left, at least on the extreme fringes, you have people who want to equate family planning, voluntary family planning efforts, with population control and racism and colonialism and eugenics. So lots more hot-button issues there. So we mostly don't talk about it.
We should mention that the photos in the book not only illustrate your points but are also visually stunning. How did you find the images for this book?
We had a small team, an editorial group that worked on this project and have worked on several past ones, a terrific photo researcher who's also a professional photographer himself. And our charge to him was quite simple. Within these various themes, these categories of human activity on the Earth, energy, agriculture, urban life, the unraveling ecosystems, go out and find some interesting images. And he did that. And we looked through thousands and thousands of photos, and we chose not just the ones that were the most egregious examples, say, of a toxic energy economy, the aerial photo of the tar sands development in Alberta that look like they're out of Lord of the Rings, it's mortar or something. So we have some of those, but also we asked for images that were simply representative of what is life like. What's it like for that fella trying to carry his bicycle through the crowd in Vietnam, or the person on a street in a major Chinese city to get through that air pollution haze to get where they're going?
There are also aerial photos showing the density of urban centers like London, New Delhi, Shanghai, Mexico City. Isn't it better and more efficient for populations to be concentrated into small areas, which leaves substantial parts of the earth uninhabited by humans?
There are some benefits to urban settlement patterns, but all of those urban areas, of course, depend. Their ecological footprint depends on resources extracted from rural areas as well. So putting all of the world in, all the human population in cities is no panacea for the problem of ecological overshoot.
You write that an area the size of South America is devoted to agriculture, an area the size of Africa to raising animals for food. Would it be possible to grow food more efficiently and thus feed more people in fewer acres of land?
Yes.
So why aren't we doing that?
Well, there are efforts to intensify agricultural production. Some of them come from our good friends at Monsanto that you were just speaking about in your last segment.
Well, in that case, you're talking about things where we stick genes, the GMOs, sometimes a fish gene, into a vegetable.
Precisely. And we don't have time to talk about biotechnology and the issues there, but I would suggest that it's an area fraught with problems.
The Population Media Center is also a partner in this book. We should point out that you've made this book available online for free. You're giving out copies of it to people who are willing to use them to spread the word about this issue. How can people request a copy?
Through the website campaign, Population Speak Out campaign website at populationspeakout.org. The entire book is online, as you just said. It can be accessed from anywhere in the world, and it is being done so. We've had a remarkable response thus far.
Well, the book that I have in my hands, it probably weighs about 25 pounds or so. So maybe
I think that's hyperbole. It's a big book, but it's not 25
pounds. It weighs heavy. It's heavy. But we have
a
link.
It's a heavy topic.
We have a link to your page on our show page at WNYC.org. When I said population control, should I have said limiting population growth? Would you have preferred that?
I would have talked about family planning efforts that help us slow and then stop and then reverse the human population trajectory. Control suggests some sort of top-down mechanism, and that is not what is needed, and that is not what is ethically appropriate.
And you're saying that the real issue is an educational issue.
It is family planning, the efforts. And I want to be very clear about this. We're not talking just about high-fertility countries. Roughly half of the half of the pregnancies in the United States are unintended. So if you can stop and slow unintended pregnancies in the overdeveloped world, you'll have a bigger impact on the global biotic community. If you can slow or stop unintended pregnancies in high-fertility countries, you may well eliminate or reduce human suffering.
Now, we only have a few moments left, but there was a zero population growth movement in the 1960s that didn't have much of an impact.
We've kept growing. Mm-hmm. And thus, we're here talking about this book. We're talking about the Population Speak Out campaign, and we're trying to get this this topic back on the topic back on the radar screen, conversing with people like you.
There are also soap operas that are being
NGO people. Partner on this effort is the wonderfully creative and effective non-governmental organization Population Media Center, which has run long-running radio soap operas that are behavior change communications that help affect social norms in more than 50 countries.
Tom Butler is the editorial projects director of the Foundation for Deep Ecology and the president of Northeast Wilderness Trust. The book we've been discussing is Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot, published by Goff. It's a big, gorgeous book. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.